I call this meeting of the Children and Families Finance and Policy Committee to order. We do have a full agenda ahead of us today, so we are going to get started. There is a quorum present, and the first order of business is the approval of yesterday's minutes. Representative Lee, would you like to move approval of the Tuesday, March 10th minutes?
One question. Thank you, Chair. My name is, not capitalized. I don't know if that matters or anything.
Oh, should the – okay. Yeah. I see that the format of Representative Lee's last name and your first name, we will get that fixed.
Just we just technicality.
Save it until tomorrow.
But thanks. So moved.
If we make that change.
Okay.
Since it is a formatting issue, we believe that we can approve the minutes and then just make that change to the typo.
Okay, so moved.
Thank you. All right, Representative Lee moves approval of the minutes with the correction coming on his name. Are there any other comments or questions about the minutes? Seeing none, all those in favor of approval of the March 10th minutes, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? All right. The motion prevails, and the minutes from March 10th are approved with the change in Representative Lee's name. So, members, first on the agenda, we have a presentation from the Minnesota Supreme Court Council on Child Protection and Maltreatment Prevention. We have two presenters joining us, Judy Nord and Aaron Johnson. This will set us up for our first bill that will be following from Chair Liebling on this same subject. So welcome to the committee. If you want to introduce yourself for the record and then get started.
Thank you, Chair. My name is Judy Nord, and I'm a staff attorney with the State Court Administrator's Office. And on behalf of Justice Ann McKeag, who is the chair of the Supreme Court Council on Child Protection, thank you for inviting us to speak today. She sends her regrets that she's not able to attend due to a family emergency.
Thank you, Chair. My name is Erin Johnson. I am an assistant county attorney in Washington County, Minnesota. I also work with the Minnesota County Attorneys Association on policy and legislative issues related to child protection and child welfare. Again, thank you for this opportunity.
Thank you for joining us, and whoever's going to kick us off, go right ahead.
Thank you, Chair. So we're just going to do a brief presentation regarding the Supreme Court Council and then a little update on where we're at with our work. The Supreme Court Council was authorized by legislation back in May of 2024 and was established after that by Supreme Court order of Justice Natalie Hudson in August of 2024. It was established as part of what is known as Minnesota's Children's Justice Initiative. The purpose of the council is to develop a comprehensive blueprint to improve Minnesota's child protection system and prevent unnecessary entry of children and families into the system. The council membership was specified according to category as part of the legislation and as part of the Supreme Court order. And for those of you that have a copy of your status report that we submitted as part of our materials, if you look at attachment one to that report, you'll see the membership. And I think that might start on page 7 or 8. So that's a list of all of our members. As you'll see, it's statewide. It is multidisciplinary. It includes everyone that's involved in child protection cases on a regular basis, from the judges to the attorneys, the guardians ad litem, the social workers, as well as others who are involved in child-related matters, pediatricians, law enforcement officers, school social workers, and many, many more. So far, the council has had 24 meetings since August of 2024. They've been virtual in the evening for 3 hours each, and we've also held 2 day-long meetings.
The focus of the council has primarily been on child safety, and as we've had discussions and deliberations, we keep coming back to that focus. Specifically, we've been looking at preventing child abuse and neglect, preventing unnecessary entry of children and families into the system, and then improving the existing child protection system. The council began by receiving a number of presentations on key topics to ensure that all council members were knowledgeable and up to speed on the scope of the child welfare system and the child protection process. And our goal was to examine all aspects of the child protection system, including prevention and early intervention stages, and then also factors to ensure the emotional and physical safety of children in placement, and also family preservation, reunification, and permanency options. We've had over 52 presentations throughout the life of the council, which I think just gives some insight into how many topics there are out there about child protection and how so many things intersect with children and families in our system. After each presentation, the council would discuss what had occurred in that presentation, identified what they had learned, looked at specific systemic issues and concerns, and ultimately after all of that, we ended up with 14 pages of concerns, and this is just from presentations that we had as part of the council. Those concerns ranged on a wide variety of topics: child safety and well-being, case management systems, workforce training and retention as it relates to social service agencies, lack of resources and treatment facilities, funding, where does our funding come from, what is federal, what is state, how does that all work together, and then processes and procedures in juvenile court and social services agencies.
After receiving all those reports and discussing those topics, the council organized those many topics into six focus areas that included maltreatment prevention, child well-being, court processes and procedures, social services agencies' processes and procedures, workforce development and retention, and funding systems. After that, the council started the heavy lifting, which is starting to identify different potential solutions and promising practices. And again, those were divided into the two main topics that are under the charge of the council, and that is preventing child maltreatment and improving the child protection system.
The council also felt that it was very important to listen to stakeholders outside of those who are representing various groups on the council. And so from April 2025 to January 2026, the council conducted 26 different focus groups with various stakeholders and communities that ranged from social service agencies to law enforcement to communities that have been impacted by the child protection system, that gave them the opportunity to raise issues, concerns, and challenges, and also to identify any promising practices or solutions or experiences they may have had in their individual experience with child protection. I would also note that in the status report from March 2026, attachment number 3 lists the focus groups that the council has solicited input from. We have a sample of some of the questions. Obviously, this was not all of them, but just to give a flavor of the questions that were posed to each focus group, really focusing on the system itself, what are the strengths, what improvements could be made, and then some more specific to people who work within the system. Was your training sufficient? What more do you feel like you could have benefited from, or what more do you need to do your job?
In addition to the focus group, we wanted to make sure that we received comment not from those smaller groups of people where we met in the focus groups, but from communities and counties and statewide. So we created a survey that was sent out statewide to the Children's Justice Initiative teams across the state, to all of the various agencies and organizations that work with children and child protection. And to our happy surprise, we received over 1,700 responses, which is pretty unusual. I think a lot of people don't really like surveys, but we got 1,700 responses. And what was even more remarkable was the fact that we received 302 single-space pages of written comments. Most people don't like filling out surveys, let alone writing written comments. So we were very surprised by that. We are still going through those and synthesizing them. As you can imagine, it takes quite a while to do that. Here are just a few examples of some of the responses that we received. And I will just read this page. There's a couple more on the next page. Again, these are just random examples of some of the comments. The first quote was that children's needs are sometimes secondary to parents' rights. The next one was the systems needs to be less contentious and more collaborative. And another one was we need more consistency across county agencies in terms of expectations, screening decisions, and how child protection is viewed as a whole. So with all of that, our next steps are to continue synthesizing all of that material. We will be refining our recommendations, and we will be submitting that by the proposed deadline of December 15th of this year. Thank you, and we welcome any questions you might have.
Right. Thank you so much for walking us through all the work that's been done. Members, any discussion or questions? All right. Representative McDonald. Okay. Well, that means that you answered all of our questions right now, and we will await the coming of the report in a few months, by the end of the year. So thank you so much for joining us today, and we will certainly follow up if the committee members have any questions offline and make sure to get that information back to everybody. So
thank you so much
for your time. Okay. So next on our agenda, members, we have House File 3877 from Chair Liebling. I will move to re-refer House File 3877 to the Committee on Judiciary and Civil Law. Chair Liebling, go ahead and tell us about your bill.
Well, good afternoon, Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. I think this might be my first appearance in this committee, and it's lovely
Welcome.
To see all of you. Well, I brought you a really good bill, Representative Nadeau. So the bill before you is a piece of the judicial branch's policy bill for the year. So you will note that that's being carried by me and by my co-chair, Peggy Scott. And so I'm going to invite my testifier, Mr. Shorba, from the judicial branch to go through it with you and answer any questions you might have.
All right. Mr. Shorba, would you introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony?
Good afternoon, Madam Chair. My name is Jeff Shorba. I'm the state court administrator for the Minnesota judicial branch. So House File 3877 is a pretty streamlined bill. There are really only two major components. The first is to clarify in statute that what are the notice requirements in divorces and legal separations without children? Currently, we believe a drafting oversight, the statute requires us to give notice to the Department of Children, Youth, and Families and to counties when there are divorces with or without children. But the only real reason to give the notice is with children. And so we have conferred with the department, and the department agrees that this is probably a drafting oversight, and so we want to clarify that as a result, the only time you need to give that notice is when there are children as part of the divorce. And then the second major provisions, these are sections 2 to 4 of the bill, relate to what Ms. Nord and Ms. Johnson were just giving you an overview on. That is the Supreme Court Council on Child Protection. You heard they gathered a lot of comments and are working to synthesize those. And so we're asking to have the deadline in statute extended to December of 2026, giving the council additional time to analyze the data. So that's the bill.
Members, I would rather ask to the audience if there's anybody from the public who wishes to testify to House File 3877 today? All right, seeing none, we'll move to member discussion and questions. Representative Nadeau.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Liebling. I welcome to Children, Youth, and Families. This is where a lot of work gets done. So there must be a significant amount of savings now. The judicial branch doesn't have to report all of the dissolutions without children. I'm teasing, kind of. But can you tell me what's the holdup with the study? Why do you need an additional year to provide this report on child protection?
Mr. Shorba.
Madam Chair, Representative, it's really to synthesize the responses. As Ms. Nord stated, we were a little surprised that so many people responded to the survey, and we believe that is because it's a very important topic. And so we want to make sure that we are thorough in letting the report speak for itself when the report is done, but that requires a little extra time. We're not asking for any more money to do this. Obviously, if there is anything left over, we'll return it to the general fund. So that's the real reason.
The justice did come to myself and co-chair West, as well as Chair Liebling and Chair Scott, during the interim and asked for some additional time. I think the original proposed date was June, but given the fact that we'll be out of session at that point in time, we said, well, you can actually have till December. Then we'll be able to gather that information. Of course, you're always welcome to submit it early. So if you've got it before December 15th, we would welcome that as well.
Absolutely.
Any follow-up, Representative Nadeau?
Yeah, and just so so the bill, we're extending it a year, not six months. Isn't it a year? We're going from June 30, 26 to June 30, 27.
So on line 2.5 is where I believe, so it's by January 15th of 2026, now it's December 15th of 2026. So from January of this year to December of this year, Representative Nadeau.
And then so it's the expiration of the commission expires on June 30th of 27, and the dollars expire. Okay, thank you, Madam Chair.
Absolutely. Any other discussion, members? Seeing none, Chair Liebling will give you last words on your bill.
Yeah, thank you. I, as you can see, it's not probably the most intense, controversial bill that you'll hear all year, or I should just say, may it be.
We've had a lot of that already this year, Representative Liebling, so this is so refreshing.
So this should be a pretty easy one, and appreciate everybody's attention to it.
All right. Wonderful. Members, with that, I will renew my motion to re-refer House File 3877 to the Committee on Judiciary and Civil Law. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? All right. The motion prevails, and you are on your way back to Judiciary, Chair Liebling. Thank you so much. All right. We have Chair Torkelson with us in the room, or not quite? Torkelson? There seems to be some sort of joke with the GOP members where I have to say his name multiple times before he appears. Is it like Beetlejuice? Oh. Oh, gosh. Okay. All right. Well, we will go to Representative Clardy. And then just come back to Representative Torkelson. So House File 3714, welcome to the committee, Representative Clardy and testifiers. So as you're a guest in the committee, I will move House File 3714 before the committee, and I will move to re-refer it to the Committee on Education Policy. As you get settled in there, Representative Clardy, I believe you have an A1 author's amendment. Would you like to walk us through the A1, or would you rather have House Research walk us through?
House Research can.
All right, wonderful. Ms. Sunderman, can you please give us a walkthrough of the A1 amendment?
Yes, Madam Chair and members. The A1 amendment, you'll see three places where it adds that either the district or the commissioner, depending on the circumstances, may require a letter or other documentation to verify a child's status in foster care. and to require that to be processed within 48 hours of receiving it. So you'll see that on lines 1.2 to 1.6, 1.9 to 1.13, 1.18 to 1.22, and 2.5 to 2.9. It also adds, it modifies the priorities for the various educational benefits, equalizing children in foster care with children ages 4 and under. It also adds kinship or relative custodians, kinship families, to the priority list for basic sliding fee child care assistance. And that is the amendment.
All right. Thank you for that, Ms. Sunderman. Members, does anyone have any questions to the A1 amendment? All right, then I will go ahead and move the A1 amendment on your behalf, Representative Clardy. All those in favor of adopting the A1 amendment to House File 3714, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? All right. The A1 amendment is adopted. And Representative Clardy, go ahead and tell us about your bill as amended.
Thank you so much for having me at your committee. Thank you, Chair, co-chairs, I should say. As many of you know, I'm a teacher. I've been retired after 30 years, and I ran into this wonderful person named Zua, who was a new mom, and she was talking to me about some of our most vulnerable kids, and that's our foster kids. And she was talking about real life experience, about stuff that she had and some challenges. And as many of you know, with things that come up, we, a lot of times we're able to navigate such situations, and a lot of times a lot of other people have a difficult time navigating. So when Zua was telling me about the three children, and I'm not going to talk too much because I want her to tell her story, but when she was telling me about the situation that she was having with after school care and like some of the transparency laws within the foster care system, I thought there needed to be a change. So this bill came about that way, and then yesterday we began our conversations with the community education people to see how this will really take place. So that piece is still going on. So that's the gist of the bill.
All right, wonderful. So to the testifiers, we'll go ahead and introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Good afternoon, co-chairs, members of the committee. My name is Osahan. I am a foster and the executive director of Foster Advocates. Long before House File 3714 was drafted, our foster leaders raised concerns about access to school programming. They understood firsthand how these programs are lifelines. Accessing these programs are the difference between isolation and belonging, instability and the confidence that carries students through school to brighter futures. And the data confirms it. Just to give one example, if you go through the Minnesota Student Survey, it shows that only 57.4% of fosters join physical education school programming versus 70.3% of their peers, due to barriers in cost, transportation, and information, not due to lack of interest. People will often say that life outcomes hinge on a series of key decisions. This bill removes barriers for families to make one of those key first decisions, outcome-defining decisions, placing fosters in school programming, which cascades into better grades, attendance, education pathways, stability, and thriving futures. You'll hear a few bills this session enhancing fosters' lives, and indeed, House File 3714 is one of them. And it's important to note that this bill also honors the sacrifices of working-class families, day-to-day constituents who reside in all of your districts. They're stepping up within their means to care for fosters. This bill eases permanency and prevents extra unnecessary placements for young people simply through prioritizing fosters for school programming. No added complexity. Fosters asked for this prioritization in the Minnesota Promise Report. House File 3714 supports their vision of fairness, belonging, and opportunity. I urge you to meet our state's promise to fosters and to these families who are trying their best, again, within their means, to provide stable homes for our state's young people. Thank you, and I'm happy to take any questions.
Thank you for your testimony. Ms. Zhu, if you'd like to introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Yes. Good afternoon, co-chairs and members.
And thank you for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Zua Vu, and I'm here to share my story and support for HF3714. I worked as a teacher for 15 years, during which I encounter many fosters, and their stories inspire me to learn more about how I could foster. I became licensed in 2021, and a few months later, a group of three siblings, ages 5, 6, and 7, came to live with me. I knew early on that reunification was unlikely. As a single woman working full-time, I was not prepared for the amount of work I was about to encounter. When the 22-23 school year started, I enrolled my now adopted children in their schools before and after school program. They were put on a waiting list because the current policy is students are accepted on a first-come, first-served basis. I then asked if there was a priority for kids in foster care. They said no. After several phone calls to the school and the county worker, I was told just days before school started that they would be accepted. The next year, we had to do it all over again, and I was overwhelmed. I told the county worker that I could not continue to foster if we could not get them into a program. After hours of calling and emailing, my kids were finally admitted. The amount of stress this created was incredibly frustrating. I want to give you an idea of the cost. In the 2 years before and after school programming cost me over $26,000. Not once during my training did anyone mention how much childcare would cost, or that I would only receive a monthly stipend of $600 for childcare for all three kids. Is this the best way to support children and families in foster care? Children that are in the care of the state. I was my kids' fifth placement. How could I look them in the eye and give them up just because school programming was too expensive? To me, this meant giving up their friends, their school, the structure and routine that we worked so hard on. This bill is about stability for foster children and providing prospective foster families with the transparency necessary to make informed decisions for their family. Members, thank you for your time, and please support HF3714.
Thank you for sharing your story. Next, we have Deborah Jackson, who will be followed by Nikki Mabry. You can come up to the microphone. When you're settled, please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Good afternoon, co-chairs and members of the committee. My name is Ayana Lee. I am a legislative assistant at Foster Advocates, and I will be reading the testimony on the behalf of Deborah Jackson, who is unable to be here today. My name is Deborah Jackson, and I am speaking in support of House File 3714. I became a foster parent at the age of 25 when I took in my niece. I did not have kids of my own. My decision to step up for my niece came from my own childhood. When I was younger, there were times when my mom was unable to care for me, and it was my older sister who stepped in to raise me. Because of her, I was able to stay with family and avoid entering the foster system. At 25, my life looked very different from most people my age. I could have been traveling, building my career, or focusing only on myself. Instead, I stepped up to become the parent my niece needed. It wasn't an easy decision. There were many moments of self-doubt and many nights filled with fear. I often questioned whether I was strong enough or prepared enough to raise a child on my own. But what kept me going was knowing that my niece needed me. She needed stability, love, and someone who would fight for her future. The system helped me finalize the adoption, and for that I am grateful. But what the system did not prepare me for was the financial reality of raising a child on a single income. After school programming and childcare were not luxuries, they were necessities. Without prioritizing these services, families like mine are left struggling to figure out how to make everything work. The costs added up quickly, and many foster parents are forced to make impossible choices between their jobs and their children's care. Fosters and kinship parents are providing stabilities and keeping children out of a system, but too often we are doing it without the resource that would make it sustainable. My niece loves sports, but we had to give them up because we couldn't afford the cost. If we truly want children to grow up in families instead of a group home or home with strangers, then we must support the families who step up when those children need them, when those children need them the most. Please support HF 3714 as it will benefit all fosters. Thank you.
Thank you for sharing Ms. Jackson's testimony with us today. And Ms. Mabry, feel free to introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good afternoon. Madam Chair and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Nikki Mabry. I am Program Officer for Pathways Home, and I'm here on behalf of Greater Twin Cities United Way. Pathways Home works with our community partners to support young people most at risk for housing instability, youth exiting foster care, and young people transitioning out of the justice system. Our work is grounded in a simple truth. When young people have stability and community, they build stronger foundations for adulthood. House File 3714 helps make that stability possible. For a young person in foster care, access to consistency can mean safety. After-school programs, enrichment opportunities, early learning, all of these are a lifeline. House File 3714 ensures fosters can get into programs without facing long wait lists or administrative barriers. This helps create spaces where they can grow, heal, and belong. At Pathways Home, we see every day that when young people have housing, consistent care, enriching programs, and adults helping navigate systems with them, they are much less likely to experience homelessness later. In phase one of Pathways Home, 627 young people exited homelessness, not simply because they found a home, but because they received the kind of supports that make stability real: childcare, priority for services, and more consistent support. On behalf of Greater Twin Cities United Way and Pathways Home, we urge your support for House File 3714. Thank you for your commitment to Minnesota's young people.
Thank you for your testimony. Are there any members of the public who wish to testify on House File 3714 today? Seeing none, we will move to member discussion and questions. Chair West.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative, for coming and presenting your bill.
Thank you for turning on my mic. my question for the author of the bill, or perhaps Mr. Berg, is amending the deduction and removing the distinction of children older than seven. Does that have a fiscal impact? I know this reminds me of a Representative Hicks bill that on North Star that had a tremendous cost. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering if there's a cost by removing that.
Representative Clardy, or to one of your testifiers? All right, we're going to go with Mr. Berg.
Madam Chair, members, I do have a fiscal note request in on the bill and the amendment that was put in. I don't know for sure if it has a cost, but it's been submitted for a fiscal note.
Chair West? Representative Nadeau?
Madam Chair, Co-Chair West, this would just reprioritize existing pots of funding. We're not asking for additional appropriations here. We're just changing the prioritization list for school programming. So we're not requesting additional appropriations here. We're just reprioritizing existing funding.
Chair West.
To be clear, I'm very supportive of the program in general. The way I read it, and might be wrong, is don't you get a reduced amount of funding when the children are over seven, and removing that would change that, or am I misunderstanding that entirely? I see somebody nodding their head that I'm misunderstanding that entirely.
Ms. Sunderman?
Madam Chair, Representative West, that is accurate. Currently, the amount for the child care allowance does reduce when the child reaches age seven, and this bill removes that distinction at age seven. So it would be the same for a child under seven and over seven, but current statute tops out at age 13 for the child care allowance.
And a follow-up question,
would that cost, if there is one, fall under the DCYF budget, or would that be under the education budget? The current motion is to move this to education policy, but if we need, we could move to education finance. Ms. Sunderman?
Madam Chair, members, that would be the cost under the North Star program.
Thank you.
The first section would be the education-related section.
Okay. All right. Thank you. To Representative Nadeau.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Clardy. I appreciate what you're doing here, and what I'm curious about is I've got a couple of questions, and I think I can get there quickly. In line point, on the underlying bill 1.18, we talk about highest priority for enrollment, mm-hmm. and then what I'm wondering about is we've got application priorities, and then we've got funding priorities, and they're not the same. So is there a conflict there, number one? And number two, if there is a conflict, which one comes first? Do the priority applications come first, and then the funding priorities are applied after that? Or do we start at funding priorities and then move into application priorities?
Representative Clardy.
Thank you, Chair KW and Representative Nivo. These are part of the conversations that we're having with community education right now. The rationale behind this is we know that parents never know when they're going to get the kids. They could get them Thursday and need housing, school, after school care on Monday. That type of thing. So we're trying to figure that out. We do know that they need to be prioritized because of like state law saying that you can't leave your five-year-old home alone. But as far as within the financial piece, that's all part of the discussion that this executive director is having with the community education right now. Is that close enough, or do you want to take it offline? What would you like?
Representative Nadeau.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for that. I'm happy to talk to you about this further because I could be completely mistaken in the way that I'm reading this. So I'll talk to you about that after, and I'll talk to my own community ed department about this as well. But I think my last question, and I've never seen this before.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
You want to respond? Go ahead.
No,
your bill.
Go ahead, Representative Nadeau. She can follow up.
Thank
after.
You. And this may, and if you can answer this, great, and maybe it has to be to House Research. I've never seen responsible social service agency listed before. Is that defined somewhere, and how? Can somebody talk to me about that?
Ms. Sunderman.
Madam Chair, members, that's the term that's used throughout Chapter 260C in statute, and that encompasses the county and tribal agencies.
Where is it? Sorry, I didn't
hear. It's in Chapter 260C uses responsible social services agency.
Excellent. Thank you.
Okay. Any further discussion or questions, members? Representative Perez Vega.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Clardy, for bringing this bill and for those who gave testimony. I've had several years, over a decade, of after-school programming work, directing mentorship, and particularly for kids who come to our programs that they want more of, and they want more accessibility of. And I think about you bringing forth this bill in these times, especially when we're seeing families foster children who, in most recent times through DOPA, you know, the accessibility and eligibility of what we're going to have to do for all Minnesota youth is crucial right now. And these are ways to expand opportunities for those voices to be circulated, and the importance of putting funding towards kids. And the age limit, I think, you know, I'm about to be a mom to a seven-year-old next month, and to think that you place a kid and say, we're going to take it off at 7 years old, and we need to make that qualify for the 13-year-olds, you know, that expands that child who is already dealing with the trauma mm-hmm. of being in foster care to have accessibility to not only to the programs, but for the family's overall general well-being of this new family. Because, you know, the foster care system is really a cry for SOS at times, not only for the child to be placed in it, with the blessing to have a family member to take those foster child services, but also for the opportunity for that family to be able to give that kid to its highest potential. And I just think cutting off the funds at seven, or not cutting off the funds, but getting less funds isn't fair. So I appreciate you bringing that amendment forward. We want to continue to be here for every child, and in particularly the most vulnerable kids. And having that access from the county to the private agency sectors is very important. So appreciate you for bringing that. Thank you.
Not seeing anybody else on the list, members. I do just want to express my gratitude, Representative Clardy, for you bringing this bill forward. As you know, and many folks know, three of my kids are adopted out of the foster care system. And so this is something that is very near and dear to my heart. They came home to our family when they were 1, 3, and 4. And I think, you know, it is truly a wonderful thing when we are, when families are able to keep siblings who are in out-of-home placement together. And this can, this proposal and any funding that goes along with it can really help support those families who might be stitching together every last penny that they have in order to keep those siblings together. So I appreciate all the work that you've done. I appreciate the story of your testifiers, and look forward to moving this along in the process to make sure that we get it right. So I will renew my motion to re-refer House File 3714 as amended to the Committee on Education Policy. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? All right. The motion prevails, and House File 3714, as amended, is re-referred to the Committee on Education Policy. Thank you, Representative Clardy, and thank you to the testifiers.
Thank you.
All right. Members, next on our agenda, we have Representative Torkelson, and I saw him come into the room. So welcome to the committee, Representative Torkelson. I'm going to go ahead and move House File 3750 to be before the committee today. It is my understanding that we will hear testimony and discuss this bill today, members, and then we'll lay it over as we wait for some input from the Department of Children, Youth, and Families. Our intention is to bring it back up prior to the first and second deadline to make minor changes and then to pass the bill on. Chair Torkelson, is that also your understanding?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Madam Chair, yes, it is my understanding.
All right. Wonderful. Well, go ahead and tell us about your bill.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Before I proceed, I understand that I'm in danger of losing my gold star for perfect on-time attendance, and I wish to plead my case.
Go right ahead.
Thank you.
You are forgiven. Some of your members were telling me that there was a time in which they had to say your name multiple times, that you would appear like Beetlejuice. So that is on the record now.
I see.
So, well, but you are not here with us, and we are glad that you are here.
Start any chanting today. So House File 3750 is about an issue that is really important to me, actually. I've had a chance to visit this facility called Ivy House in New Hall, Minnesota. It's a short-term crisis child care center. So if you've got an emergency that kind of came up suddenly in your family and you want, you need child care at short notice and for a reasonably short time, Ivy House supplies that kind of service. They've been doing it for quite a while. One of the things I really like about it is it brings a variety of community resources together in one place to take care of kids, and what could be better than that? The problem we have is that the current licensing system doesn't really address the needs of a facility like Ivy House. So they have to have two licenses, and neither one of those current licenses actually really fit their needs. This effort is to actually create a license that is specific to this kind of service. We believe that if we would have this license in place, it would actually encourage other communities across the state of Minnesota to set up similar facilities. With that, I'm happy to turn things over to people who know a lot more than I do. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Wonderful. So there are two testifiers signed up today, and I know I've had the opportunity to speak with Ivy House and learn a little bit more about what you all do, and I think Chair West
has had that opportunity as well. So we're excited to hear what you have to share with the rest of the committee today. Feel free to introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Well, Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak today. My name is Steve Turbold. I'm a volunteer board member at the Crisis Nursery in New Ulm. Ivy House provides free, short-term crisis child care for families facing overwhelming circumstances. Their parents navigating medical emergencies, housing instability, mental health challenges, or other temporary crises who need a safe place for their children while they stabilize the situation. Our services are voluntary, short-term, and we're prevention-focused. In the past year alone, we have responded to 500 helpline calls and provided nearly 1,000 days of free child care. That reflects the significant need, not just in New Ulm and our surrounding communities, but farther out. We have supported families as far away as Maple Grove. Last year, we had the opportunity to present at the Minnesota Social Service Association Conference. And since that presentation, we've had conversations with professionals and community leaders from across the state who recognize the same service gap in their own regions. Since then, we've received calls and inquiries from communities throughout Minnesota asking how to establish a crisis nursery. Some have been from our neighboring communities and others have been much farther away, including conversation with an individual from the Iron Range who sees firsthand how families there lack short-term crisis child care options. What we're hearing consistently is that this is not an isolated need. Counties, nonprofits, and local leaders understand that traditional daycare does not meet emergency crisis needs, and residential facilities also serve a different purpose. Short-term crisis nurseries can fill that prevention space in between, helping families before situations escalate into deeper system involvement. Now, the challenge is, as Chair Torkelson mentioned, is that the current dual licensure structure is not replicable to other crisis nurseries. Organizations that want to step forward encounter regulatory barriers and operational confusion, and just it makes it difficult for them to get up and running. This legislation would create a clear, specific licensing framework tailored for short-term crisis nursery operations. It does not require taxpayer funding. It simply establishes an appropriate structure so communities across the state can safely and effectively provide this preventive service. We believe it's a practical solution that strengthens families, protects children, and allows communities statewide to respond to a clearly defined need. And I will turn it over to our founder, Amber.
Ms. Collins, go ahead and introduce yourself and proceed.
Sure. Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Amber Collins, and I am the founder and currently serving as interim executive director for Ivy House in New Ulm. My story is that I have a background in elementary education and taught in Duluth for a while, and after moving to the Minneapolis area, was continuing education in infant mental health, effects of toxic stress on children, ACEs, adverse childhood experiences, child abuse prevention, and at the same time started to volunteer at the Greater Minneapolis Crisis Nursery, which has been around for 40 years. And through that experience, I saw firsthand how powerful a short-term break for a parent can be. I saw how families would come to the crisis nursery stressed, with overwhelm, not knowing where to turn or how to support their family in their time of crisis. And then upon having their break to be able to address their adult need, they were able to come back at a de-stress level and able to support their family better. The resources that a crisis nursery provides families is plentiful. All crisis nurseries across the state connect families to many resources. So when their children are staying at the crisis nursery, the parent is working to stabilize their situation so that they can be the best parent they can be and provide in the best way for their families. As crisis nurseries provide short-term voluntary care, Ivy House has been functioning since 2017, the Greater Minneapolis Crisis Nursery in Minneapolis, and then now, more recently, Star House, who we have a representative here with us, is in St. Paul. The three of us are the only residential facilities here in the state of Minnesota. With that being said, we know this need extends well beyond our three facilities. The services we provide are needed throughout the state. Steve mentioned some of the reasons that families would use a crisis nursery in your little one-page sheet that you all have in your packet. I just want to touch on a couple of them. medical emergencies. Families call us when a different child in their family has a medical emergency and they need care for their other children so that the parents can go and be with their children. Or if a child has a long-term chronic illness and need to come to the Twin Cities or other facilities for long-term treatment, we can provide free care for their child so that they can attend those medical appointments. If a parent has a medical crisis, we have had our social workers in our emergency room call us, and we can go and get children so that they can stay with us while the parent receives crisis medical care. Mental health crisis, families can call us for respite breaks. They also can call us if they're needing ongoing mental health appointments, if they're attending AA, if they're attending, any type of support services. We're able to care for children so that the families can get those support services to better their family life. Housing instability, we often provide care for families who are looking for to create better housing stability for their family. So we can provide care for the children while the parents are working on creating a stable place for their family to be. We often work closely with our homeless shelter in New Ulm. Same is true for surrounding areas. Providing care for families so that they can go to job interviews to work on stabilizing things for their family. Unfortunately, the challenge we're at is that crisis nurseries don't fit perfectly into our licensing, as Representative Torkelson said. So the dual licensing framework that we have right now does provide a lot of conflicts for our families, a lot of extra work for them. This legislation would establish a licensing structure that reflects how crisis nurseries actually operate. It maintains safety and accountability while removing regulatory barriers that were never intended for this type of care. It doesn't request taxpayer funding, and it simply creates clarity for us, the providers. From my experience, both in the metro and in greater Minnesota, I can confidently say that this service fulfills a critical prevention gap for families. It strengthens families, protects children, and allows communities to respond before situations escalate. Thank you for your time, and we're here for any questions.
Thank you so much for sharing your story. And all the work that you are able to do to support families in your area and across the state. Are there any members of the public who wish to speak on House File 3750 today? Right. Seeing none, we'll move to member discussion and questions. Representative Zalesnikar.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Rep. Torkelson, for bringing this bill. I also got to visit Bethany Crisis Center in Duluth, and got to see firsthand the wonderful services that the short-term model creates for, you know, somebody ends up having to go into surgery, has no one to watch their kid. There was just a lot of different examples that you wouldn't even think of, all of them. And to have a place where a child's not going into ER, it's just not set up for that, for young toddlers or kids to, you know, be removed from their mom or their dad. And to have a supportive environment. So thank you very much for doing this licensing and getting things in order. And it's wonderful that we have these services in our community. So thank you.
Representative Hicks.
I also want to say thank you. So I have had lots of friends who do crisis nursery as foster parents. And we always need more because in our community, we don't have something like this at this point in Rochester. And it is really, really hard when Mayo Clinic calls child welfare at 9 o'clock on a Saturday and says, hey, we got a parent here who is unresponsive, was found unresponsive and has had a heart attack. And we have a 4-year-old and we don't know. Who's on call, right? So I think something like this is just great. I'm glad we can make that work. I think the more creative solutions we have for what is real life, life is messy, and real life is just messy. And so the more opportunities we have to make that easier for folks when life gets messy is great.
Vice Chair Nelson.
Thank you, Chair KW. Chair Torkelson, thank you for this bill, and just a couple of questions around it. Is there an age that this is really kind of looking at to be, obviously there's a minimum, but, you know, is there a maximum age you're looking at of, you know, where does that fit in of, you know, I think Representative Hicks kind of brings up an interesting point here. You know, it's like at some point, you know, we want to keep them out of the foster system, but it's, you know, is it where is that age that it's really looking to serve the need?
Yeah, that's a good question. Sorry. Currently, Ivy House can serve up to age 10. The Greater Minneapolis Crisis Nursery serves up to age 6. Star House, same, age 6 also. The regulations in the current licensing weren't specific. For us having the dual license, age 10 was specific to our special family child care license we have. The CRF shelter license we have didn't have specific guidelines for that.
Vice Chair Nelson.
Yeah, thank you for that. And I think, you know, however the license is drafted up, I think, you know, whether it's to the specific, you know, age or whatever, however that is best, I think that it's there's definite need for it. And, you know, I just thank you for everybody that has been involved in this and getting it to this point, and for those that are providing this care, thank you. And sounds like there's a lot bigger need than the three facilities that are in the state. So I just also want to thank all the supporters of it. It sounds like it's privately funded or through donations or whatever. And I just, you know, this is so crucial to keeping families stable. And just thank you for everybody that's involved in that.
All right. Not seeing any other members on the list, I just want to share my support for this proposal. Chair Torkelson, I appreciate you bringing it forward, and the timing works well. We're doing a lot of licensing work in this committee this year, so we'll await the feedback from DCYF in the next couple of weeks so that we can keep things moving along. But now, Chair Torkelson, I'll allow you some closing comments.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I wish to thank my testifiers for making the trip here to the Capitol and offering their expert testimony today. And I'd like to thank the committee and you for hearing this bill. I really do feel this is a genuinely valuable service. And if we do get this license in place, it will actually, I think, encourage other communities to establish similar services, which will be valuable to children anywhere they're established. Thank you again.
Well, with that, members, we'll lay over House File 3750, and we'll see you soon. Okay. Now we have House File 3024 from our very own Vice Chair Hansen. So as Vice Chair Hansen is getting settled up there, I'll go through the motion. Representative Hansen will move that House File 3024 be before the committee. The plan today, members, is to lay this bill over. And Vice Chair Hansen, you have a DE1 amendment. Would you like to give us a little background, or do you want to go ahead and move the DE1 at this point in time before moving on?
Thank you, Chair. I would like to move the DE1 to get the bill in the shape that I would like. It's a reflection of ongoing negotiations.
All right. Vice Chair Hansen moves the DE1 to House File 3024. All those in favor to get the bill in the shape the author would like, members, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? All right. The DE1 is, the motion prevails, and the DE1 is adopted. So, Vice Chair Hansen, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, members. I appreciate the opportunity to discuss House File 3024. This bill seeks to establish a foster youth Bill of Rights. Minnesota is one of only 5 states that does not have a Bill of Rights for foster youth, and it's the only county that's based in a county system without one. Foster youth rights, as they are now, are unclear. They're spread out across statute, rules, and agency policy guides. It's hard to follow, and especially hard to explain to young people. By creating a consolidated foster Bill of Rights, we can align everyone in every county of Minnesota, make sure that they're operating from the same standard of care, and that there's a clarity on the protections for young people who are often the most vulnerable. The Office of the Foster Youth Ombudsperson, or OOFI, as we love to call them in our committee too, has been leading on this project, as they should be. In many other states, when the Ombuds Office was created, it was passed in tandem with a Bill of Rights. The Ombuds Office is often the place responsible for monitoring and educating foster youth about their rights. But at the time when we passed that bill, we thought that might have gone too far, so we decided to break this up into pieces. UFI reviewed the language used in 45 other states' bills of rights, conducted research into current laws in Minnesota, and the policies at the Department of Children, Youth, and Families. In addition to this, the office connected with Fosters, again with DCYF, MAXA, and many other stakeholders. The hope is, with passage of this bill, is that foster youth and all those who support them during their time in foster care, that they'll all have a consolidated place to refer to, and so that they and everyone knows their rights while they are in care. Foster youth deserve to know what their rights are when they're entering care, and they should be able to easily and tangibly access them when concerns arise. We don't currently provide that to our foster youth, so this bill fixes that. We will have some testifiers here today that can speak to the impact that this bill could have if you help me pass it. And in your packets, I'd like to direct you to the thick packet of letters of support from many stakeholders, including but not limited to adults and youth with experience in foster care, doctors, nurses, social workers, child protection workers, foster families, psychologists, professors, school specialists, guardians ad litem, the Council for Minnesotans of African Heritage, Aspire Minnesota, the Minnesota Indian Affairs Council, Children's Advocacy Institute, Children's Justice Task Force, Foster Advocates, Ombuds Offices for Families, for Mental Health, for Developmental Disabilities, Youth Prize, and so many more. This is what community support looks like. This is what it looks like when stakeholders come together to compile this information and get the bill before you today. You'll also see one contingent support letter from MAXA, and I am pending a request from their take on which of the rights in here and aspects of the bill can be cost neutral or acceptable this year. But I do appreciate them with their contingent support as well. Thank you, Chair.
All right. Thank you, Representative Hansen, for that walkthrough. Members, even though the amendment that we moved was referred to as a DE, and it was a DE, it's actually coded as the A26-0101. So, Representative Hansen, why don't you move the A26 to House File 3024, just in case.
Thank you, Chair. I loved explaining the A26 amendment, and I would move that the A26 be moved.
All right. Members, any questions on the... the rearranging of the coding of the amendment. Otherwise, all those in favor of the A26, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? All right. The A26 amendment to House File 3024 has now been adopted. All right. And we'll move on to your testifiers. We have a number of testifiers signed up. First on the list, we have Misty Kuntz, who will be followed by Des Neustrom. So if you want to come up to the testifiers table, and once you're settled in, feel free to introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair and members. For the record, my name is Misty Kuntz, and I serve as the ombudsperson with the Office of the Foster Youth Ombudsperson, referred to as UFI, as you got to hear. You've already got to hear some bills related to specifically supporting foster youth, and I'm excited to talk with you more about this particular bill. In addition to over 15 years of experience that I have as a social worker working directly with or in support of foster youth, I am a foster. I use capital F foster, following the lead of our younger advocates, to refer to those of us who have experienced foster care, no matter how or when we left. I spent about 5 years in foster care here in Minnesota with my older siblings, and like many fosters, these experiences shaped me in how I view the world, how I view family, how I view systems, and so much more. Our office opened because of the advocacy efforts of young people with experience in foster care, and some of them are here today in support. We're grateful to them, and we're grateful to the legislature, including many of you in this committee, for hearing those voices and taking meaningful action. Prior to the creation of our office, there was no clear, independent pathway for foster youth to raise concerns or report potential violations of their rights. Since May of 2024, when we opened, we have reviewed nearly 400 concerns from children, youth, and adults from at least 55 counties across Minnesota. We have several public reports we have shared, which outline some of the investigatory work and the trends that we are seeing. When agencies like ours are established, as you heard from Representative Hansen, they're often created alongside a Foster Youth Bill of Rights to help create a uniform standard of care. Minnesota remains one of only 5 states that lacks a codified Foster Youth Bill of Rights, and we've seen from the poor implementation of the Sibling Bill of Rights here in Minnesota, passed in 2018, that our agency can serve a critical role in ensuring foster youth know their rights. The absence of a Foster Youth Bill of Rights in our state has created inconsistent practice for foster youth, their loved ones, and the professionals working to help navigate a complex and challenging system. Without a Foster Youth Bill of Rights that clarifies the minimum protections for youth, these variations result in confusion for workers and different experiences for youth and families, depending on which of the 87 counties they live in. This bill is the result of hundreds of hours of research and discussion, and you can learn more about our process for drafting in the supplementary materials that you received. But to summarize, we reviewed the rights documents for those 45 other states, we centered the experiences of Minnesota foster youth, and we incorporated feedback from over 100 professionals, including the Department of Children, Youth, and Families, MACSA Children's Committee Leadership, Children's Law Center, and several of our Ombuds colleagues. It is with these collective voices that we have crafted a bill that we hope truly reflects the needs and realities of those in foster care. We learned from our colleagues in other states that broad, general rights are typically not effective and that we need to be specific in our language. As an example, it's not enough to say that foster youth have a right to privacy. We need to be specific and say cameras are not allowed in rooms where youth are expected to bathe or change clothing. For children in poverty, Minnesota spends more on child welfare than most other states. However, we spend about half as much on foster care compared to other services. It's not easy to meet a higher standard of care, but it is overdue and worthwhile. You will see that in our materials that many of the rights included in this bill are not new. They already exist somewhere in statute, rule, or guidance, but they're often poorly understood, and therefore they're not implemented well. It's not a fix for every problem in our system, but it is a huge step forward and sends a message that we expect better for our foster youth. The Foster Youth Bill of Rights is a practical tool relying on existing programs and structures that ensures that children and youth have the support to navigate the complexities of the system. It affirms that fosters are deserving of protections that safeguard their well-being, as much of a normal childhood as possible, and a strong foundation for their success. Thank you for the chance to speak today, and I'm happy to answer questions that you may have.
Thank you. I meant to say this earlier. For those of you who are following online and not in the room with us today, we have some very adorable guests in the audience. And I just want to say that children of all ages are always welcome in the Children and Families Committee. So feel free to stay and join us and chime in if you need to, little ones. All right, next we have Des Newstrom, who will be followed by Vivian Dudley. Go ahead and introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Okay, hi, I'm Desiree Newstrom. Thank you, Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Desiree Newstrom. I'm a 26 business owner, a mother, and a foster. I was placed in foster care in Ramsey County, and I was adopted out of the system. After my adoption, I continued to deal with child protection, and I turned 18 due to my adoptive family's emotional, physical, spiritual, and psychological abuse. Despite being adopted, I still wasn't cared for. I found myself being bounced around youth shelters repeatedly, taken away from my adoptive family, and placed into other abusive homes. While in foster care, I didn't know my rights. I felt in my gut that something wasn't right, but I didn't have the words or the knowledge to understand what was happening to me was illegal. I repeatedly spoke up about the abuse I was enduring, but my voice was ignored. I was dismissed as just another troubled child. The system overlooked my pain and no one listened. My voice was as important as any other child's, but it wasn't treated that way. Had I known my rights, I could have advocated for myself and sought the proper care I desperately needed and deserved. I believe that if I was given the support to have my rights upheld while in care, that this would have helped me stabilize mentally and emotionally during those years. This would have had prevented so much of the trauma I carry today. When I hear these stories like mine, I hope that this helps you understand how important this bill is. I'm here today to ask for the bare minimum for fosters to have legal standing in accessing the protection, respect, and normalcy they deserve. We know that this should be provided by our parents. While in care, our parents are being in the state of Minnesota. The Foster Bill of Rights is the first step in making sure that fosters' rights are upheld, and it is important. And an important one. Many legislators can go to bed at night without the emotional weight of this system, but we live it and experience it, the residual impacts every single day. Given this, I urge you to support and advocate for the passage of the Foster Bill of Rights. Thank you.
Thank you for sharing your story. Next we have Vivian Dudley, who will be followed by Travis Matthews. Go ahead and introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, chair members of the committee. For the record, my name is Vivian Dudley. I'm 28 years old, a woman of God, a social work student, an advocate, and a foster. My foster care experience started in Anoka County at the age of 16, and it also ended in Anoka County when I aged out. I'm here to talk about the Foster Youth Bill of Rights. Looking back, what would have changed my experience in foster care is transparency and accountability. Which is what the Foster Bill of Rights does. Fosters deserve basic rights. During my foster care experience, I often felt that foster care was like being incarcerated, literally and figuratively. Fosters deserve to have normal childhoods. We deserve the right to activities and the right to simply be children, especially if the state is our parent. For me, activities were never even an option. I don't even know what interests I might have had just because I was never given that option. Fosters deserve basic human decency. One of the most impactful and painful moments during my time in care was when my social worker took away my right to show up and give my own victim impact statement. That decision took away my autonomy and caused further trauma. Fosters deserve support in parenting. When I became a parent in foster care, I was not even given the option to parent my child. The state that was supposed to act as my parent took my child away from me. No one told me my parental rights, or no one provided the adequate resources for me to be able to do what I want to do in this world. The action the state has took has impacted me for the rest of my daughter's life. When systems fail to support foster youth, they create generational trauma. When it should be guiding and having a light for ensuring children are loved, supported, and given resources to succeed. Fosters deserve to know their rights. If I had known both my individual and parental rights, I really believe that I would have been able to secure my family and stay parenting my daughter. This is why accountability and transparency matters. The Foster Bill of Rights gives fosters the ability not only to feel like they deserve dignity and fairness, but to see that those rights clearly and advocated for them. Being placed in foster care should not mean losing our childhood. And it should never mean losing our voice or our children. Passing the Foster Youth Bill of Rights means foster youth will know their rights. Those working on our case will be held accountable, and the system will finally be expected to treat young people in care with the dignity every child deserves. I urge you to pass this bill so the next generation of fosters grows up knowing that their rights are genuine and they have the chance to thrive. The current state of our child welfare system just ain't cutting it. So fosters deserve the Foster Youth Bill of Rights. Thank you.
Thank you for sharing your story with us today, Ms. Dudley. Next we have Travis Matthews, who will be followed by Ms. Akpada Tanias with Foster Advocates. Introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Yeah, thank you, Chair, as a member of the committee, for allowing me to testify today. My name is Travis Matthews. I'm the Foster Post-Secondary Success Coordinator at Youth Prize, so I'm testing on behalf of Youth Prize today. It's my first committee of session, so bear with me as I get back into the groove of testifying. It's very nice to see many faces I know today, and I hope each of you have been well. The Foster Bill of Rights would help ensure that youth, counties, caregivers, caseworkers, and service providers across the state are operating with the same understanding of the standards fosters deserve. You'll hear this statement and theme, and you have throughout the testimonies today, and I would encourage you to pause and reflect. and understand what that means for right now. Right now, the system lacks a clear expectation of holistic care and understanding of rights that foster deserve, and it leaves UFI with a very heavy task to enforce accountability and to make things right for fosters without a clear unified standard of care. For many of the fosters engaged within my program through the education training voucher, I often learn about the failures of their care. Through conversations and programming, some of our youth have disclosed their access to healthcare was turned off. They couldn't access extended foster care benefits. They couldn't contact their worker. And I sometimes have to follow up and get those things to happen. And a multitude of other violations. Having an established Bill of Rights allows young people to turn to it and demand accountability for the things that's happening to them. I think it's important to mention that the bill aims to ensure complete access to resources, to benefits, and other supports that fosters need to stay afloat. This acts as a preventative measure, right? And it helps fosters from falling through the cracks of the system, something that the state unfortunately knows really well. As someone who grew up in foster care myself, and I now work every day supporting fosters, it's one of the greatest privileges of my job, I know how important it is to have a clear understanding of your rights. Young people in foster care should not have to guess what they're entitled to or advocate alone for the care that they deserve while they're in the system. HF 3024 moves us to a closer system that's transparent, it's consistent, and accountable for the fosters it serves. I would ask each of you to support this legislation, and I'm happy to answer any questions the committee may have. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Matthews. Next up, we have Ms. Akpata Tanias. Sorry if I'm pronouncing that. And who will be followed by Renee Carlson with True North Legal. If you can.
Good afternoon, co-chairs and members of the committee. Again, my name is Osahan, and I am a foster and the executive director of Foster Advocates. I find it mind-boggling that in 2026, in our beautiful state of Minnesota, we protect patients with a Bill of Rights in hospitals. Packing house workers with a Bill of Rights for meat processing, and borrowers with a Bill of Rights for student loans. But when it comes to the state's own children, fosters, we fail to enshrine their rights in a consolidated document. That is a reality I find unacceptable and deeply disturbing, and it is for that exact reason I am testifying in strong support of House File 3024, the Foster Bill of Rights, so that we can change this ironic situation by creating a concise, consolidated standard of care for every young person under state custody. No longer should foster care be contingent on who your caseworker is or what county you happen to be in when you entered foster care. A unified and clear enshrining of foster's rights and autonomy in safety, family, education, finances, and health services is a vital step toward providing the care we as a state have promised fosters. Furthermore, this legislation is brought to you by fosters. Foster Advocates partnered with the Ombuds Office for Foster Youth on focus groups, ensuring fosters' voices directly informed the bill and aligned it with community needs. This Foster Bill of Rights unifies scattered laws, rules, and policies into one accessible document. Every young person deserves to know their rights and who can help when they're violated. I urge you all to establish this uniform baseline of dignity and empowerment for the collective children we as a state are tasked with caring for. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony and for your work with fosters. Finally, we have Renee Carlson. Introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good afternoon, Chair Gatiza-Watoon, Chair West, and Representative Hansen. My name is Renee Carlson. I serve as General Counsel for True North Legal. We agree that every foster youth deserves a safe, loving home with safe, loving adults. And I'm here today because foster parents in this state have expressed some concerns about House File 3024, Subdivision 10 of the A26 Amendment, which forces foster parents to, quote, affirm and support a child's gender identity, including but not limited to counseling, medication, and other supported services. This language goes beyond addressing basic needs, unlike similar bills passed in other states, removing placement opportunities for foster youth by excluding qualified foster parents whose beliefs conflict with these mandates. Data shows since 2018, the number of Minnesota foster families has decreased by 35%,
reducing the number of available homes to 3,200. There is a shortage of Minnesota foster families, and this bill would exacerbate the problem of long wait times and no placement for these youth. It's important to note that in Massachusetts and Virginia, legal challenges to similar laws and policies with gender identity mandates have resulted in states removing those mandates for foster families in both states. This bill creates a broad range of sex rejection procedures with life-altering consequences such as severe bone loss, removal of healthy body parts, sterility, and mental health crises, consequences that detransitioners, doctors, lawyers, and recently juries refer to as medical malpractice. This right increases the risk of abuse for youth like Sage Blair, a female who struggled with gender distress and under horrible circumstances became a ward of the state, was placed in an all-boys home, and was sexually assaulted. Foster youth have a right to an intact body and to be supported in a range of therapies without invasive medical procedures. Foster kids are looking for just one safe adult. Foster families who sacrificially love these kids for who they are and in turn help them love their whole self are an asset to these children and to the state. Thank you for your time.
We will see if there are any other public members of the public who wish to testify on House File 3024 today. Seeing none, we will move to member discussion and questions. Chair West.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Hansen, you mentioned that some of the bill might have some costs, and I'm assuming it's being laid over partly for a fiscal note. Do you have any expectations? You know, it's going to be hard to spend money on this year, and we'd like to do as much of this bill as possible. So what areas have costs that you see, and do you have any kind of idea how expensive that will be?
Vice Chair Hansen.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Co-Chair West. I don't know what those are right now. I'm waiting for the folks who told me yesterday that there were some costs. So, we'll wait here. And we work well together. Like, as you can see in this packet, there's a reflection of a, like, self-assembled task force that has put this together, and they've been working together for a long time. So as we continue to identify that, we all know that the department is very busy doing a lot of things. And, you know, we don't expect them to have a lot of this stuff ready before they know that there's going to be a hearing on a bill, right? They can't do this on every bill. And so I'm not saying that by hearing just the other day it's a problem, but it is why. And that's why the bill is being laid over. Eventually, it will need to go to other committees. I'm trying to honor that. The work can continue here as much as we can. And I will say that I know we don't have money this year, so if there is aspects of this bill that we can pass this year by removing those that cost, I would ask the committee to support doing so. I think we should start somewhere, given that we are one of only five states that don't have this and the only state county-run state that is not doing this yet.
Follow-up, Chair West.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, I cannot imagine being a foster child, having a disagreement with your caretaker, and just navigating that sounds like the most awful, awkward situation to be in. The last testifier brought up a couple of court cases in other states that have had similar language, like in Subdivision 10, struck down in what, Vermont and Massachusetts. Have you looked at those lawsuits and cases and seeing how we can prevent, if we were to pass this legislation, from it getting struck down in court?
Vice Chair Hansen.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Co-Chair West. Vermont and Massachusetts are no Minnesota. That's what I'll start with. I do have testifiers who can tell you more about how this is already existing in much of our law. This is, again, much of the Foster Bill of Rights is existing in other aspects of law and is kind of summarizing it all together. Right, and so I have Misty can share more. Otherwise, Travis from Youth Prize also has a bit of information. So you guys let me know how deep you want to go into that, and if we want to go down that path, I have plenty of folks who can talk about that. But I'll turn it over to Misty for now, if that's okay, Chair.
Sure. Yeah, to the ombudsperson.
You got it. Thank you. Yes, as we were, you know, doing the extensive research for this bill, obviously looking at things that already exist in child foster care licensing guidelines as far as expectations, And what is in there so far is the expectation to increase understanding of and respect for a variety of things related to a foster youth's identity, which includes their sexual orientation and gender identity. So our intent with this entire bill was to look at things that non-foster youth have access to related to the normalcy of childhood, things you heard earlier in terms of support and care that would have really impacted them, and so trying to essentially equalize that for youth in foster care, and that would be the same for that subdivision 10 as well.
Right. The gentleman from Youth Prize, would you like to high-level respond as well?
Yeah. I just wanted to come up and say, it's not often that I talk about my personal experience in foster care, specifically maybe the details about it. I think I'm open about my experience in foster care, but never really the details. I'm more than happy to talk about, specifically as a young gay man, what it was like to go through foster care, right? I come from a northern county, Itasca County, Grand Rapids, Minnesota. Love the Northland, moved down here for college, been here ever since. During my time in foster care, right, growing up gay was a hard thing to figure out. Some of my workers were not maybe the most supportive people. I want to take you back to a conversation that I had with one of my workers. I'll make this very quick. I know the committee's short on time. We were on a walk outside and at one of the residential facilities I was at, and my worker at the time thought it would be appropriate to ask me, maybe you're gay because you've been sexually assaulted by men. Do you think that's an appropriate question to ask somebody at the age of 14 years old? I know that this section seems alarming to people, and I understand that, but those are the types of questions that are being asked sometimes of children. And so I understand that foster parents want to have a religious freedom and have that opportunity. I respect that. But children aren't, you shouldn't be able to ask children those types of questions, right? Children should not be disrespected in that sense, right? A child should be wrapped up with affirming support, regardless of their gender identity, regardless of their sexual orientation. And those types of questions are unacceptable, and that's what this bill addresses, is that type of harm. And so I just wanted to take a moment and kind of talk about that personal note and understand like what that means on an impact level of why this needs to pass. Thank you.
Chair West, any follow-up?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for sharing your story. Well, actually, my brother actually very recently came out in the last year. So wonderful. I have heard a lot about how difficult it can be. Yeah. So that was an enlightening experience for me, I will say. I do have concerns about this getting struck down as we have had in other states. So a lot of that comes down to compelled speech and religious expression. And I'm not saying we necessarily need to chuck every single thing here in Subdivision 10, but I know that Representative Hansen has done a tremendous amount of work on this, and this is a very important bill that we need to keep as much as possible moving through the process. I'd like to see an amendment when we bring it up to address the specific things that were an issue in those other states. And I believe, you know, Minnesota's Minnesota, maybe we can find a better way. But I don't want this to get derailed, the Foster Bill of Rights, on some of the content of Subdivision 10. Because, again, as the testifiers have said, incredibly important. And I think the committee largely agrees on that.
Representative Perez-Vega.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Rep. Hansen. I know how hard you advocate and fight, and I want to say thanks to the testifiers, Des and Vivian, and also Travis for your work with Youth Prize, a tremendous organization and asset to our state of Minnesota, and particularly for our children who put themselves in even more vulnerability by sharing their testimony. And thank you, Director, as well, because your lived experiences of survival is how we make laws better. And it takes a lot to do that. I want to circle in on the impact of why we have to continue to support these initiatives of HF 3024 when I think about my first term in children and families, and we talk about the African American Family Preservation Act and the impact that these circulate in an ecosystem to be supportive of religious community, of community in a whole, and cultural competency, and what it takes for a child to be connected. I had you know, the impact of just cultural programming and arts and being able to connect to the smells of what your family's food was like that you can still remember. We talk about the growth and expanding for mothers and first-time moms. And when I hear, Dez's story, is the trauma that she's lived and now being a mom and how these programs of what she's being able to give testimony to can save the next mom, can save the next kid. And the vulnerability of that should really leave with all of us as members and how we want to be able to advocate, use the power of the people who have put us into these places to change these systems that have continued to traumatize the most vulnerable. And when we think about who are those most vulnerable, we heard from them today. And they come from different shades of brown, different levels, different cultures, different background. And so thank you, Rep. Hansen, for your continued work. I look forward to building with you and focusing on those community cultural connections that we need to continue to support and advocate more than ever right now. Appreciate you. Thank you.
Representative Altendorf.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Rep. Hansen. I just had a question, for the sake of getting this passed, because it sounds like, did I hear we're one of five states that don't have a foster? Yeah. So I think we're all in the same, boat that we would like to see this passed. And I was just brought to my attention that Idaho recently passed a bill. I'm not sure if you're familiar with it, Rep. Hansen, but it was number 724, and that one is a much shorter version, so it's like 2.5 pages. I think I heard you say, Rep. Hansen, that there's a lot of duplicative information, that it is law in other places. And so, again, just in the spirit of wanting to get it passed, I'm wondering if that is something that you would consider, to look at something that's a little bit more compact, that's doing what we want, but it's not duplicating and repeating laws that are other places within the Minnesota state statute.
Vice Chair Hansen.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for the question. What's before you is what the advocates and the hundreds of people who have mentioned are wishing to pursue at this time. We'll continue conversations as it's laid over, but I'm going to stand with my team on this one and let them know that we're going to fight for what's here. And what's got costs, like I shared with Co-Chair West, is what we'll probably end up pulling out, because that is the reality of the nature of the budget this session. So that's what we're willing to move on at this point. Again, it's being laid over, so we'll have lots more conversations to go for. If we're monitoring what's happening in the other body that I shall not mention, and we'll see what happens there. So there are some opportunities potentially for a conference or something like that too. Thanks. Okay.
Representative Hicks.
Thank you so much, Chair, and thank you for this, Jess. Thanks, or Representative Hansen, sorry. Thank you to all the testifiers who are here today. I think I'm the only licensed foster parent on the committee, currently licensed?
Currently.
Others have previously been licensed. And so I just want to say that I have no concerns as a licensed foster parent. I've read through the whole thing. I have zero concerns about my ability to do everything in this document. And the reason that I have zero concerns is because if, perchance, there was something that I didn't think I could do, I would say, I don't think I can do that, because that's not in the best interest of the child, if a child needed something that I couldn't do. For example, if I had a child who had a medical condition that I didn't think I could do because I didn't have an accessible home, for example, I would say that. Because as a foster parent, I get to say that. I get to say, I don't think I'm the right fit. And if you as a foster parent can't say that, you shouldn't be providing foster care. Because the person who should be at the center of those discussions is not the foster parent. The person whose rights and decisions and concerns and priorities should be at the center of those decisions is not the foster parent. It is not the county worker. It is the child. And it should always be the child. And I've been doing this long enough, and I've had enough kids in my house that I can tell you that when those things don't happen and the conversation is about what the adults want and the adults' feelings and the adults' priorities, it never ends well. And so I am 100% supportive of this. I am so grateful for the work that has gone into it. I know how hard it is. And I have had conversations with kids who have showed up in my house who are like, what do you mean I get XYZ? I've never gotten XYZ. And I'm looking and I'm like, you've been in care for 3 years. How has no one told you that you have a right to that? We need to be able to tell them easily and concretely what their rights are so that they can advocate for them, because nobody is a better advocate than the kids. But they can't do it if nobody tells them what it is. And frankly, not everybody should be in foster care. Not everybody should be foster parents. And if you can't do it, then don't.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a question for the author in subsection 9, 11.13. Just a question for you regarding, says choose not to participate in cultural, religious, or spiritual events and practices. And I understand, I know what the words are saying, but as a young lad of seven children, sometimes we didn't want to go to church with mom and dad on Sunday, especially as teenagers, we're out too late. So let's say a student decided, you know, I'm not going to get up and go to church, or maybe it's once, maybe it's twice, maybe it's just a very rare, in that case, no big deal, but and the parents were really wanting them to participate. Would that be, if this should become law, strictly against this child's Bill of Rights?
Vice Chair Hansen.
Thank you, Chair. I think religious trauma is real. I think kids that are forced like that to go to church, it has long, like lifetime lasting impacts. We may not like it. We may not agree with it. We may think we want our kids to do that, right? Every kid grows up to be an adult, though, and we don't need to send them into adulthood with that. So I would hope parents who are forcing their kids to go to church are doing so in a way that is loving and understanding and talking to them and trying to share their values and help move them. I don't want to get too deep into this. I did accidentally go to a conservative Christian college once, and I could go down that route with you. However, I don't want to go too far given where we are today. But that's my initial take on it, is that I would hope that anybody who sees a kid that's pushing back on that, it does not traumatize them in order to bring them to faith. I think that's problematic, personally. But I will let Missy answer more. But I think that would be the thing I would ask this committee to keep in mind, is the kinds of trauma that a lot of adults carry and where that stems from. What are those roots? Because that is what preventative work looks like, to help adults grow into safe, healthy, productive members of society. Thank you.
Ombudsperson?
Yes, thank you. I think we all know that spirituality and religion are important parts of identity. And so I can speak to both the section that you're talking about, and I think starting with the section behind it, is the right to participate in cultural, religious, and spiritual events that are meaningful to the foster youth, and the importance of that choice. And then the follow-up there is the point that you had asked about, is to choose not to participate in cultural, religious, and spiritual events and practices. This was based out of feedback specifically from people with lived experience in foster care, sharing their experiences of essentially being forced to go to events and to spiritual places that didn't align with their, you know, spiritual identity and their religious faith. And so it's just the importance of supporting that with the trauma that comes into foster care and all of the changes that come with that, the importance of allowing young people to have some choice in that.
Vice Chair Hansen.
And thank you, Chair. One more thing that just came to mind, I just remember what Representative Hicks said, is that, you know, as foster parents, it's different than parents, than legal parents. And I think that's the kind of also difference I want to bring. And to Missy's point is that, you know, kids can come into foster care at any age. And so if they are practicing one religion and that's what they've grown up with and that's what feels right to them, you know, going into a home where they're then forced, you know, to do something. I hope that we can ensure that foster parents are having understanding conversations like that, and maybe getting curious about each other, and maybe it can be a learning process, right? So I think beyond just helping foster youth understand what these rights are, I hope it helps bridge some of those gaps that can often cause trauma or cause broken homes to happen too. So.
Mm-hmm. Representative McDonald, follow up.
Thank you, Chair. Yeah, just for the record, I don't mean in a harsh, traumatized way. I mean in a loving, tender way that my spirituality and most spirituality, no matter what religion, is done in a loving, tender, common sense way, not a forceful that brings on trauma. So I recognize that. I just wanted to bring that up. My mother was in foster care and was adopted. Thanks be to the Lord that she had a good foster parents and the very, very good parents in the end, because they adopted her. So I understand fully this story and the bill and the reason and the effects of good foster parents, but some concerns in the bill, but that was one of them, so thank you.
Thank you. Co-Chair West has a brief question in relation to this.
Yeah, along the same lines. So it's illegal to leave a child at home who's under five. So if, like, say they vehemently do not want to go to this religious service, what is, then can the parent not go, or are they required to get a babysitter, or how does that work if this were law?
Ms. Kuntz.
I think that's a good question, and I think that, you know, depends on a variety of things, you know, age and what's available. I don't recall if we have exact language in here that none of this is intended to put a foster parent in a position of having to make a decision that would put a child in an unsafe situation. And if that isn't there, I think if we need that clarification, that that's not the intention ever, is to put a person in that position.
Vice Chair Hansen.
Thank you. And I would hope that a person that's doing foster care would not leave a five-year-old home. I would hope, and I would be very impressed by the five-year-old who is, like, standing with their religious conviction. Like, I think that's a kid worth, you know, discussing with. I want to take that kid out for an apple juice, right? So I think that's a big thing. And, I mean, sometimes places of religion are where trauma is, and so I think sometimes it's just really important to have these conversations with kids and understand, why don't you want to go, rather than, like, we're going, we gotta go, even if it's nice and loving and all of the things. You know, the home can be safe, but oftentimes it's outside of the home where trauma happens, and that could be why they don't want to go. So I think, like, hopefully this just spurs other conversations to encourage open conversations that feel safe, supportive, and healthy.
Vice Chair Hansen, we'll move to closing comments. Members, I'm super proud of us because I think we're going to end on time today.
Even on one of my bills, Chair. Thank you, everybody, for hearing this out. If you want to continue to discuss it, you know where to find me. I would also encourage you to keep the packets with the letters in it, because those are folks that, should you ever have questions about child protection or what the experience of fosters are, I bet everybody in this packet would love to be a resource for you. So please keep that, and thank you always for standing up with me and alongside me in solidarity with foster youth across Minnesota, so that we can show them that we can do better, and we're committed to it. So thank you.
Thank you. And with that, House File 3024 as amended is laid over. members, I want to say happy birthday to our wonderful committee administrator, Coley.
Happy birthday.
And her twin sister, who is referred to as Little Carly. Hello, Little Carly. I am Big Carly. It's spelled the same. So happy birthday, Little Carly. And Coley's gift is today the committee ending on time.
Yay.
With that, we will be, we're adjourning. Next meeting is Tuesday the 17th, and Co-Chair West will have the gavel.